Welcome to a new series from War Master Podcast, featuring interviews with the great and the good from the wargaming world. I will ask each guest a series of 10 questions, 5 general and 5 specific to their field of expertise. First up is Sherwin Matthews, friend of the show and writer and games designer for Steamforged Games. Thank you for taking part, Sherwin. I'm sure that people are going to be really interested to hear your insights, so let's get straight into the questions. General questions. Question 1. Describe your journey into wargaming.
So my journey into wargaming was much like a lot of people my age will remember going and getting their copy of HeroQuest, an old board game by Milton Bradley Games, which was made in conjunction with Games Workshop. And if for those of you, well, no, I don't think any of your viewers or any of your listeners, I should say, will be surprised or will need an introduction to that game. I remember one Christmas, my cousins brought it to the family, sort of family celebrations, and we sat down at my grandparents' kitchen table and started playing it with one of my uncles, who was trying to steer these kind of, you know, us young kids through this thing and not really understanding the type of game it was whatsoever. And I immediately fell in love with it and begged my parents to go and get a copy. And then subsequently had no one to play it with, but that didn't stop me hungrily devouring and playing it solo as much as that is possible, and then really looking to lots of other stuff. And it's around that time that, just talking to my cousins, they introduced me to this mythical Games Workshop company that made all of these magnificent miniatures. And I think the rest is really from there. I mean, as I'm sure very many people can very easily imagine it, I found myself playing that, or more precisely kind of going out and finding miniatures. There was a shop nearby. I went and bought my first Warhammer product, outside of a White Dwarf in a newsagent's, was a copy of Battle Magic, for which I think was Warhammer Fantasy, although it wasn't called that then, third edition, which again I had. No, any armies or any army books or anything else like that. But that gave me loads of lore to read through about tech lists and magic items and colleges and magic and all sorts. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. I have a lot of fondness for that.
Question 2. Tournaments or casual gaming? What floats your boat?
It's an interesting one, tournament gaming or otherwise, or casual. I've been both. I kind of returned back to wargaming. So in the previous question, you kind of said, well, you know, how did you get into the gaming world? And I played that for a long while, ever since, I don't know, probably age 10 or so and upwards. I played for a long while until I kind of hit the end of secondary school and really stopped, as a lot of people I think do, and didn't come back for a good solid kind of, you know, 6-7 years. And when I did come back, I found myself playing some Blood Bowl first, and then getting into a game that I never thought I'd play, i.e. Warhammer 40k. Afterwards, because a lot of people at my local gaming club that I joined really, really liked it. And I really wasn't about tournaments then. I kind of, yeah, wasn't interested in going and hanging out with a bunch of competitive people playing lists and all sorts. And I really wanted to play friendly, casual games and make leagues and campaigns and things, and really do it that way. And I played in a couple of them, and I did go to a couple of tournaments, and they just really underscored my hatred for that kind of mentality and that kind of player. Because I remember playing with my Dark Angels against a guy who had a Space Wolf army that he'd obviously just net decked, and I couldn't possibly beat it. I might as well have not deployed my army on the table. My codex was from 4th edition 40k, his army was from, you know, literally the most recent thing. It was hideously broken. And my underpowered Dark Angels had no chance whatsoever. And I remember walking away from the table, having taken my licks, and just going, yep, this isn't for me at all. But interestingly, much like a lot of people, I then got caught up in the revolution that was War Machine. And that dramatically shifted my understanding of tournament games in quite a very meaningful way. And I understood what a tight rule set with excellent balance and a lot of other things could really give you a really interesting way of integrating with your hobby that I'd never even considered before. And I think the most important and exciting thing from that was War Machine really changed the way that a lot of us looked at gaming, and a lot of us thought about tournaments and thought about various different things. And But at that point, became someone who went to tournaments. I mean, at one point, I was going to one pretty much every week. I was traveling around an awful lot. And then since then, I've kind of come out the other side, which is interesting. I kind of found myself playing games where I just don't actually really want to play in tournaments. I kind of just want to play casual, friendly games. I want to sit down with a buddy and just blast through a couple of games in an evening. And the tournaments I do go to are more about playing casual games in a slightly more formal setting, which is one of the reasons why I actually really like Warmaster. It's a game which just isn't in any way, shape or form really that competitive. If you try to take it super seriously, you very quickly find holes in the rules or things that just are very much rules as intended rather than rules as written. So I very much appreciate that. And that's something where I think we all find our natural needs and our actual where we want to be with games and that sort of thing. And I may go back to tournament games at some point if I find a rule set that actually inspires me. But having played a lot of that for a good 6 or so years, it almost got to the point where I got very tired of pursuing this mythically unbeatable tournament list, and every single one of my games is super competitive and feels like it's all, even with the best intents between friends, just becomes this really high pressure experience that I just simply don't want. And that's going to be an interesting one to see whether I shift back into that, because the mindset for that is a very, very different place to where other games are. And I don't necessarily know I want to return there, but we'll see.
Question 3. Historical, fantasy or sci-fi gaming, which genre are you most attracted to?
So historical, fantasy or sci-fi, it's got to be fantasy. Although I don't mind sci-fi games. I generally just find that they have to have a really interesting or unique aesthetic to kind of keep my interest. For example, I don't mind a space fleet battles game like old Firestorm Armada was, for example. Something like that's quite fun. But I find that fantasy is really the one that gives me so much more interesting. I think fantasy gives everyone such a broad spectrum of different ideas to play around with and different things to explore and different avenues. So much more interesting. And I think, the theatre of the mind is a really good and key part of how we integrate with games as people playing them, as people designing them, and every other thing, and every other sort of almost level of that. And I find that fantasy is the one that, for me personally, evokes the most interesting and most varied responses, which I really appreciate.
Question 4. Which figure, either historical or fictional, best sums you up?
So this one's a bit out there, and I do feel very, and it's a really interesting question because I do feel very, I suffer from imposter syndrome at the best of times. So trying to find a historical figure that sums you up without feeling incredibly self-aggrandizing or trying to, in a strange way, feel very, it just feels very egotistical, and I'm not necessarily comfortable with that. But that said, it will be one that it qualifies as a historical figure, although not one you'd expect. It has to be Henry Rollins. And for those of you who don't know Henry Rollins is a guy who is still alive, obviously very much a recent historical figure rather than an older one. He was the singer for Black Flag, which is a very, very influential punk band or hardcore band, or depending on which way you look at it, way back in the day. And they were, I mean, it's not so much the story of Black Flag, it's more so much the story of afterwards. Much like Henry had he's part of the alternative scene and went around to gigs all over the place and shows and all sorts of things and toured constantly. And then when Black Flag, broke up, he was free for about an afternoon before he formed his next band and immediately ran into his next project and then basically has toured constantly. And he's a figure who, in the meantime, has wrote books, he's done spoken word shows, and he's an incredible inspiration. He's one of the most positive role models I could ever think of. I've actually seen him a few times on stage, sort of in various different guises, as either as band, playing music, or alternatively, I've seen him sort of doing spoken word things. But he's, what's really interesting, he's very versatile, but mostly it's because he's someone, he doesn't drink, he doesn't do drugs, he's always been extremely focused. He wants to experience the world in a raw and visceral way that is only him. And I really respect that. And his work ethic is insane. He never ever takes a day off. Now, I'm not saying that's the best thing, but it's very much a thing of his whole ethos is simply like, right now he's, you know, somewhere, you know, he'll be sitting there and he'll go, right now it is whatever time, so it's 15 minutes past five on an afternoon, and I will never get that time back. Whatever I do in this minute is never coming back. It's never rolling around again. I have only so much life. I want to fill every single moment of my life with something. I don't want to get to the end and go, God, I wasted so much time kind of just, you know, bumming around, sort of thinking deep thoughts about nothing or just being lazy. He really wants to throw himself and apply himself at everything. And, you know, there's good things and bad things about that. And you can take from what you will. But the biggest thing I've always taken from Henry is just this idea of everything he wants to do is with purpose. Everything he wants to do is deeply thought through and focused on. Everything he wants to do, he finds meaning in. It's never blind kind of action for the sake of it. It's always coming from a place where it's very much, this is my current situation. How do I change? You know, how do I react or deal with, or who am I in this particular thing? If something happens, he wants to adapt and move forward. He kind of looks at himself and he kind of thinks it over, or he kind of evaluates constantly. And I really respect that. And I've always been a role model. He's always been a role model of mine, someone I've looked up to, in the sense of, you know, if we can all find a little bit of Henry Rollins in our lives, then we're all doing good.
Question five. You can take one game with you to a desert island. Which game are you going to choose?
So I guess if I'm blocked and I'm trapped on a desert island, I can take one game with me. The honest question is what's the format? I mean, I'm guessing you don't really have electricity or chargers there, so it can't really be an electronic game, because at a certain point it's going to become a brick. Nothing else, no matter what console it's on, unless I can, you know, charge via solar panels or something. If I have to take an electronic game, I'm taking, it's got to be one of the Resident Evil games, or maybe probably Fire Emblem Three Houses, which is a recent one, and I'll regret saying, because there's so many amazing games out there, but I've sunk so many hours into that game, and there's so much gameplay into it. It's incredible. And I thoroughly recommend anybody who's got a Switch checking it out. There's so much there in terms of storytelling, in terms of gameplay depth, there's all sorts. But outside of that, if I have to take a more conventional game, I mean, maybe it's something like Go or Tac or a more traditional game that obviously is got lots and lots of depth in it. Go especially, I think, is a very, very untapped thing. And for a lot of gamers, they don't really think about that. I discovered it earlier this year and I'm hopelessly addicted to it already. I really, really enjoy it, and there's so much depth to it. I can see very easily why centuries of people have really found so much to look at with that game and understand. I mean, otherwise, I guess you could take a deck of cards, which is kind of cheating, but it's got to be something you play on your own, I guess, because if I'm alone on that desert island, it's going to be fairly one-sided and boring. So probably let's just go. For the moment, we'll just say Go, because I think you can probably play that against yourself, or at least think about it that way. Otherwise, maybe a solitaire board, and then I'll try and get that marble into the middle.
Specific questions. Question one. How did you become a writer for Steamforged Games, and what tips do you have for someone aspiring to become a writer?
So I became a lead writer for Steamforged Games. I was I met a guy called Matt Hart, who's now my boss, and he's creative director for Steamforged. And this was way before Steamforged was a thing. Back in the day, Matt was just a guy who'd been working on video games as a producer. And he came back to our local area in Chelmsford, and he went to his local club, which is the Bunker, which is where which is one of my local club, and I was president at the time. And he came along one weekend. It was on a Sunday session, one of our rare ones of those, just to play some War Machine with one of his friends. And we got kind of chatting, and he said, I'm going to make a game. I'm going to put it on Kickstarter. It's like football with axes. And he called it Guild Ball. And I was intrigued from his description. And at the time, I'd kind of been working on some short pieces and some other bits and pieces and some other stories and things that came out in various different formats. And he just talked to me a little bit about it, and it sounded interesting. And I kind of went, well, you know, I'm a bit of a loose end at the moment. You know, have you got anybody to write the lore? And his eyes lit up. And knowing him as I do now, he probably, you know, that's the sort of thing that really makes him excited. And he went, no, I haven't. And we kind of sat down and we chatted about his favorite authors, who, fortunately enough, they, a lot of them sort of matched up with mine. And then afterwards he said, well, write me a small piece, which I went away and did. I did it in about, you know, a few days, and sort of spent another couple of agonizing days editing it, fired it back across to him, and he loved it. And on the spot, he went, you know what, I want you to write everything for Guild Ball. This is amazing. This is exactly what I envisioned. And from there, I mean, the rest is relative history. Guild Ball as a Kickstarter came out, and it did well enough that it really started a new company, Steamforge Games. And then we came into, you know, we obviously came into existence. And at some point after Dark Souls, and the company started really ramping up, I went from freelancer to, or sort of pseudo staff, to actual staff, and went from there. So that's really it. And obviously from that point, I kind of then went on to writing Guild Ball stuff, to writing Dark Souls stuff, to then fulfilling a lifetime dream of writing Resident Evil stuff, which is kind of cool. So yeah, it's been quite the journey. Something, I guess, if I have to give advice to anybody who's aspiring, it's very different being a games writer or a writer for a games company than it is an author. So I can only speak to a certain extent, but the most fundamental advice I have is good for anything like this, which is, the first one is, when you are writing, you never, ever, ever want to leave your current employment that you have during your day job, whatever it is, unless you are making as much money from writing as you are doing that day job. Simply put, as wonderful as it sounds, taking time out to kind of concentrate on writing and become really good, it's a very, very hard world to break into. Very, very hard. And being somewhere where you can, you know, I'm under no illusions as to the fortune I've had with this, but being able to become a writer and then, you know, no matter how good or bad you may be, is very slim. And people, it's always slightly saddening when someone says, well, you know, I quit my job doing what I was doing because I want to concentrate on writing, because sadly, that will, you know, unless you can sustain yourself, then you will be doing that very short term, and you won't be building a good model where you can write for any length of time when you actually have work either. So it's really not going to help you. So that's the first piece of advice. The second one is to be prolific. Write as much as you can, write as often as you can, because it is like any muscle. You will be exercising it. You will get better the more you do it. And really, you know, get your name out there. Start a blog to start with, and write the bits and pieces that go in there, and advertise that wherever you can. Jump into forums and, you know, really sort of involve yourself with that stuff. A lot of writing is about who you know rather than what you know. Having the right people in the right place is always good. And it's good for your confidence as well, when you kind of put stuff up and you get kind of people who critique it. So actually, this is really good. That feels fantastic. Or they'll be able to offer you pointers and mistakes that they will have made on their way. That's always really good. Except short story anthologies are a great place to get your name out there and put some first publishing on, even if you don't actually get paid for them. You know, everyone's done kind of a few free bits here and there just to get your name in there and get the experience of working with editors. That's really crucial. Understanding how you can talk to editors to say, well, you know, I kind of like this bit, let's not change that, or discuss with them ways you can modify things without actually losing your intent, is really important, because editors don't just say, I need you to change this and this and this, and then you just roll over and let it happen. Sometimes you have to kind of really work with them to get your voice or your message across. So there's lots of different things that, you know, pitfalls to find into, but that one's a really good one. So it's self-promotion, and also making sure that, you know, you've got a stable base with which to do this thing. That's the key crucial things I could say to anybody who looks at becoming a writer.
Question 2. The first board game you worked on was Resident Evil 2 with Rich Loxham and Matt Hart. Can you talk us through the process of designing the game Resident Evil 2 and what the game meant to you personally?
I'll start with the last part of the question, which is, Resident Evil to me is an incredibly powerful and moving thing. I'm a huge fan of the game, Resident Evil 2. I have been ever since I played the original Resident Evil way back in the day in 96 when it came out with my friend The Shape. And then Resident Evil 2, when that came out a couple of years later, played that to death. At the point where I actually got to start designing the board game, I'd already clocked somewhere in the region of over 500 hours of gameplay on this thing over the years, which is quite a lot considering it takes me about 2.5 hours to finish it. But yeah, it's something where Resident Evil means the world to me. It's a game series what I grew up with, and I really fell in love with it in many, many ways over the years. You know, going onto forums and chatting with fellow fans, getting to really explore the universe and the intent behind it and all the other stuff, the lore. I really enjoyed that and deep dived into it, and it informed a lot of other gameplay for I really like enjoyed playing, back on any different console or other games, and really informed what a good game could be to my mind. So getting to actually work on in the franchise and actually release a game which actually is a Resident Evil game has been a tremendous thing. I can't stress enough just how much that's living a childhood dream. It's insane. And then especially the crowning moment I think I've got to say of my career so far is seeing a tweet from the original director of Resident Evil 2 saying he'd got the board game. Way back in the day, a young Sherwin sat there and bought Resident Evil 2 and played the hell out of it, and wanted to tell everybody who made the game just thank them profusely for being able to give me that experience. And then to see years later I made Resident Evil 2 and the director of that game has bought my game, just blew my mind. Absolutely blew my mind and made me so insanely happy. So I'm not really doing it justice, I'm gushing a little bit, but that's how much it means to me. In terms of the experience of making it, the crucial thing we always try to do with every game is to drill into what the core DNA, to use Matt's phrase, is of that game. And it's about understanding if you want to recreate an experience, a video game experience on the tabletop, you really have to understand what it is that makes what's so compelling about playing the video game. What's the core experience someone has? So for Resident Evil, that was the survival horror themes, which, if you want to break it down, is really about suspense. It's about terror. It's about resource management. It's not about action. A lot of people don't have the right conception about Resident Evil, especially the early games. They're not about running around and blasting everything that moves. If anything, they're about running away from things that attack you. It's about, really picking your fights and creeping through places where you really don't want to be. It's about scary, scary situations that aren't jump scares, although there are those in there as well. It's that growing realization that, you're kind of plumbing through the darkness. It's running through dark areas and finding an oasis of light, and catching your breath. It's about the fact that you don't realize you've been holding your breath as you've been sort of creeping through a place until suddenly you go, oh, God, okay, we're somewhere safe. It's that. And that's what we try to recreate with the board game. We always try to look at this from a perspective of, how do we replicate, how does the tension deck recreate that sense of suspense that players have as they creep through the world? How do we use mechanics from the players' inventories and bullets and guns and stuff to recreate that sense of my ammunition is running out, I can only got so many bullets left, how can I face down these enemies? Pushing enemies and using doors to kind of make your way through rather than killing them. Lots of it is really thinking intelligently about how you interact with the environment or how you interact with the board. So there's lots of ideas like that that we put in there, and that's really the big decision points that I think went into Resident Evil 2.
Question 3. You are now lead designer of Horizon Zero Dawn. How have you found that process of leading a design team and the pressure that comes with it?
So Horizon Zero Dawn was an interesting challenge. Coming off the back of Resident Evil 2, where it was very much more of a solo project, there was oversight initially from conversations with Matt and so on, but a large part I kind of just went away and made it a lot myself. Horizon was a larger game with obviously a team that we were working on. And I think it comes with its own challenge, the same as any project manager will tell you that working with a team is always offers its own challenges and it offers its own things, even with a really close-knit, focused team. And, the best of people who are used to working together, there's always things that just working with numerous personalities always, occasionally comes up with one thing or the other. It's always a difficult thing to broach and how to make sure that you can get the best out of any particular individuals to make sure everyone's focused on the same thing. And Horizon Zero Dawn was a bit of a trial by fire because obviously we were working to a very high standard, licensor as well, which was no different with Resident Evil or any other one we've worked with. But Sony and Guerrilla were very much more involved with this project. They wanted to be constantly updated. They wanted to really work hand in hand with us to really bring this game to life. They're very, very passionate about their games. And that's not to say other people aren't, but Sony and Guerrilla both wanted to be involved at a much more integrated level, especially in the early design. And that meant there was often a lot of back and forth. So there was a lot of pressure there as well to not only get it right with the internal team, but also to communicate sort of second hand a lot of what feedback we were getting from Sony and Guerrilla, as well as our own sort of ideas as designers and everything else. There are a lot of meetings where we kind of say, hey, this is really cool, let's do this thing, and then it just doesn't survive first contact with Sony or Guerrilla, and we have to go, yeah, so that thing that we said was really awesome, actually we're not going to be doing it, because you know, having sort of really understood where the drive is going, or, you know, we've talked it through with Guerrilla and actually perhaps that's not the best thing for the project or whatever else. And to be fair, there's no bad feelings or anything there. It's just to be super clear, it's almost more so much, you know, with any creative process, there's always several layers of iteration. And some things just don't ever make it off the cutting room floor. There's loads of ideas that seem like they're amazing in theory, and then when you actually start playing a game with them, just don't feel right. And some of it is that. So, yeah, it certainly has its own challenges, especially if you can imagine, if you say if you have four or so people working on it and in design or development, then all of those four people have their own ideas they want to throw at it. And somewhere along the way, you have to be the person that says, yep, and that's great, and I want to take that, and we'll perhaps look at folding it in sort of different ways, but we just can't use it right now. And sometimes it's about relaying that message on, and other times it's kind of making sure that everyone's contribution feels valued and everyone kind of feels like we're addressing the stuff they think is an issue or whatever else with the game. So very much different experience to Resident Evil, but extremely rewarding. And obviously the game that came out of it is amazing. He says completely egotistically, but I know from everybody who's played it, they've really enjoyed it. So certainly I think that's a very, very encouraging thing. So I think for, as an experience, I couldn't have asked for a better team to work with, and I couldn't have asked for my colleagues at Steamforge are amazing people, and I couldn't ask for better people to have done that as a first team building and team leading project for me. So it's very, very cool.
Question 4. Without breaking any NDAs, can you let us know what you're working on next?
Do you know, I can't actually tell you because of the aforementioned NDAs. I can't tell you what I'm working on next. I can tell you, obviously, the various different... I'm working on several things at any given time. So, obviously, we have Peaky Blinders. That's coming out soon. We have... That's one I've been designing on. Obviously, working on the Gears of War card game. We know that's in the... Or that's something that I've been working on in the background. There's a couple other things that I can't talk to you about right now, purely because we haven't announced them just yet. And then there's one very large thing which is looming on the horizon very soon, which I really can't tell you about, but I really wish I could, because it's amazing. And I can't wait for people to sit down and play it. It's going to be really, really cool. But I'm sorry to say, right now that's a too much of a loaded question for me, Barry.
Question 5. What do you imagine the wargaming landscape will look like in 5 years' time?
I don't know where wargaming will be in 5 years. Do you know, wargaming is a really interesting one. I think I look at games like Shadespire and God Tier, and I see those as the future of miniatures gaming. I think the same way that a lot of people would of my generation looked at historical games and kind of went, yeah, that's the thing that, you know, a lot of the greybeards play. A lot of the older generation play a lot of historical games and Napoleonics and stuff. And that's not really for us. We have, you know, fantasy or 40K or War Machine or whatever else. And there's not really that element of interest in it. I think for the next generation, I think we will see that. And games like the ones I've just mentioned will be the historical games of that time. Simply put, I think that we'll see more people playing games like Shadespire, and that's what miniature games will be to those people, simply put. I think games like Warhammer and 40K will just be a thing of the past. I mean, Games Workshop will always carry on being Games Workshop, but even if you look at their model for now, how they work, they're very much built around this idea of being a miniatures company. They're almost Airfix models at this point, given the size of them and the complexity. And, you know, their market is now just not in just gamers anymore. It's painters and it's hobby enthusiasts. And I think that's something where we should remember it. It's something where I can see that conceivably we find a plate. We keep on moving ourselves over to card games. We keep on looking at media where we integrate, you know, apps and electronic devices and so on. And all of these go hand in hand more with board games than you do miniatures games. And people's patience, as is shown by the growth of skirmish games for painting huge armies, is simply dwindling. And I, unless there's a sort of a renaissance of these things or resurgence, I simply put, I'm not sure that miniatures games have their place anymore. It's just a very difficult model in the industry to work with in terms of how you promote it, in terms of how you sustain it, in terms of how you manufacture it. And it'll be a really interesting one. Really, really interesting one going forward. Anyway, thanks very much, Barry. Hope this is what you needed. Bye.
So all that remains is to say thank you to Sherwin for coming onto the podcast and talking through those questions with us. Best of luck in everything you do in the future, fella, and look forward to seeing you across the table soon.